Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, listeners, be sure to check out SlipDisc.com for the latest inside information on classical music now. Before we start today's episode, I want to share some super exciting news. We're hosting a live taping of Speaking Soundly, and you're invited. Mark your calendars now for Wednesday, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in New York City at Lincoln Center's David Rubenstein Atrium. I'll be sitting down with the amazing Grammy Award-winning mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato. We'll discuss her early beginnings, her life as a singer, the creative process, and some of her more recent projects, including her return to the Met Opera stage this spring in the Hours. And best of all, it's free. That's right. No tickets are needed. Just show up. Again, don't miss our live taping of Speaking Soundly as part of Lincoln Center's Hear It Here podcast series on April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in New York City. For more information, check out lincolncenter.org/presents. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY. I'll see you there. Louis Cato is a Grammy-nominated multi-instrumentalist, producer, songwriter, and the band leader of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. While he can effortlessly perform in any genre on every instrument under the sun, his ultimate goal is to create music that resonates with his audience.
The difference between mastering an instrument and mastering a relationship with the entity of music. The latter is sort of where I feel like I landed, where the world makes sense to me. Plugging into that first and foremost is what I'm interested in always.
You're listening to Speaking Soundly, a backstage pass to today's biggest stars of the music world. I'm your host, David Krause, principal trumpet of the Metropolitan Opera. During each episode, you'll hear me speak with inspiring performers about their creative process and the personal journey that led them to the stage. You're a multi-instrumentalist, and I'm whatever is the opposite of that. I've played one instrument, the trumpet, my entire life, but you play every instrument. So first of all, what am I doing wrong? Secondly, and more importantly, how do you account for this natural ability you have to approach and express yourself through any instrument you decide to pick up?
Thank you for the vote of confidence. I've long thought of myself as the cliche trope of jack of all trades, master of none. And in my brain, logically, there's only so many hours in a day and only so many days in a lifetime. So having the joy and inspiration of knowing so many people like yourself who are absolute specialists and virtuosos on their instruments, I think I realized a long time ago that that might not be my calling, to be the best at any particular instrument. When I was younger, I was sure of trying. When I was, you know, in high school, playing classical tuba and euphonium, trombone, that was sort of like the path I was on. I famously told one of my instructors that I thought I was going to master the trombone. And
at what age was that?
Oh, this is like 15.
But so what does he say to you when a 15-year-old kid comes up and said, hey, I think I've mastered the trombone. What's next?
He didn't really let on. He was just sort of like, yeah, okay, all right. And then meanwhile, we're playing like Tchaikovsky and the Firebird and Holst and like all sorts of unfun key signatures that blew my whole world open. But I was up for the challenge and I learned a lot. But later, he would make fun of me for the rest of my life. That'll never get old. And I can laugh now because, you know, the kids say the darndest things.
Fast forward now to your introduction to American audiences is Stephen Colbert saying that you're a musical genius. And if given the afternoon, you can learn to play Mozart on a shoehorn. I know that's just something funny to say, but at the same time, you are adept at many instruments. And even though you say you haven't mastered them, you do manage to master the art of communicating through the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
As you approach different instruments, do you feel like there's an innate sensibility that you have just to figure something out the same way an engineer can look at a schematic and have knowledge of that and feel at home? Do you feel that kinship with musical instruments to a certain extent?
Yes. I was sort of thinking like the difference between mastering an instrument and mastering a relationship with the entity of music. The latter is sort of where I feel like I land and where the world makes sense to me. Plugging into that first and foremost, and then the instrument comes, and however to make music out of that is what I'm interested in always. I think it's largely based in curiosity, and then it's sort of from there, it's like the with these really basic building blocks of sound. Like if I pick up an oboe and like figure out the mechanics of how sound is made, once I find a way to get the sound, then it's like, what is that? How does it feel? Can it be better? Or does that feel like music? Is that a house to build a dream on? Can I stack on from here? And then it's like the building blocks of like, you know, if there's a few notes that are maybe available, that's cool. Starting and stopping the note. And then it's like dynamics. Can I play the note a little louder, a little softer? Sort of just expands from there. But I think I used to really poo-poo on how simple-minded I feel like I am, especially when I went to Berkeley. Like all these guys and gals from all over the world were just playing circles of, had just like vocabulary from so many forms of music that I was not yet exposed to. And I grew up in the South, and melodies and rhythms seemed just so simple in comparison to everyone else around me. But nowadays, I sort of embrace it as just a part of who I am and what my perspective is. So, I don't know, I find that I don't, especially when I'm making my own music, I don't need a lot in terms of facility to connect with the entity, you know. But it is like sort of like maybe a bit like the engineer metaphor of like building blocks. But for me, the building blocks are tone, sound, dynamics, rhythm, and then it stacks on from there, depending on the limitation of the instrument and the music you're trying to make.
And what about practicing? Like you said, by the age of 15, you felt like you had mastered the trombone. What about progressing on the instruments? What does practice mean to you?
Well, you know, interestingly, I did have those phases where I was locking myself in a room to learn things, to get things under my fingers. But it was always in the pursuit of facilitating that connection with the music or a piece of music that inspired me. You know, like when I was in my bass phase, I was less interested in learning every mode and scale up and down the neck in every way that I could possibly play it. But I was very interested in figuring out how in the world Jaco just played this bebop head on a fretless four-string bass with the harmonics and that sounded so resonant and deeply musical. And so those questions would have me night in hours into days locked in the room trying to, you know. And in the course of that, you develop a relationship with the instrument sort of like as a byproduct, I think.
Mm. You started the drums before you can walk. And at the age of 2, your parents bought you a drum kit. And so what's amazing that you took to it right away, but I find as a parent, what's more amazing is that they decided to sacrifice their home, their hearing, and their sanity by giving a 2-year-old a drum set. What in the world inspired them to do that?
Dude, I feel the same way. I have 2 kids myself, and I'm just like, what? Really? Wow. First of all, it just makes me extremely grateful to my parents. I talked with my mom about this recently, that it was the consistency with which I was banging on things and finding rhythms, and also she needed her pots and pans back, apparently. So when they got me the drum set, she said I practiced without fail every day of my own accord.
At 2?
Yeah.
You don't have your own accord at 2. I don't even know what that means. You were born in Lisbon, Portugal, because your dad was in the military, raised in a small town in North Carolina in what you call a musical bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about your early musical influences within this bubble.
Well, first and foremost, my mother. She is an incredible musical, spiritual being herself. And she started playing the piano when she was 4 years old. She grew up singing and playing in the Church of God in Christ in Omaha, Nebraska. She has a very distinct way of singing and playing that absolutely, unequivocally has been my deepest influence as a result. Her left hand is very distinctly influenced my bass playing. Her right hand is very distinctly influenced my concept of harmony. I mean, she's like number one, you know?
Her genetic imprint on you is probably apparent when you look at a picture of her and you could see some of yourself in that, but how does it feel that when your bass playing reminds you of your mom's left hand when she was in church, when you were beside her? How does that make you feel?
Very lucky. Very cool. I mean, honestly, like a deeper level, I feel lucky and grateful. But like on a superficial level, that's cool. The things can be passed on in that way. It just speaks to how powerful it is that music can have those strands that are just as potent as a piece of DNA.
As you're growing up in this very tight-knit community within the church, you weren't exposed to any music that wasn't church music, right, until high school. What was that first introduction like to rock and pop and the jazz and the whole world of music that was out there? That must have been overwhelming since it all came at once.
I mean, at first it was just like, wow, 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 gobble, 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 you know? But then it was like, Jimi Hendrix is a great example because I didn't have footage. I had audio recording and I didn't have anyone that I was watching do it. So I just wanted to learn the notes, but there was so much more than just the notes that I didn't know. And I distinctly had this feeling a couple times in my life. One, when I was looking to like graduate high school, and another time when I was leaving Boston. And both of those times, I felt this feeling of having reached a ceiling. Like, this is as far as I can go on my own. I know there's another level, but I have no idea what it looks like or where it is or how to find it or get there. I just know that like there's more within the things that I already have learned. And then later, in that Hendrix example, just being around and getting to watch people and then getting to watch footage, you start to find that, like, there's 10 different ways to play this note and different dynamics in which to do it. And then another 5 or 6 combinations of pickups that make it sound and feel totally different. Endless depths, you know, like not this way, but this way. Yeah, I'd say more so than overwhelming, I was just feeling like an implosion of need to learn whatever else is outside of here, but I don't know what it is.
And in pursuit of that, after high school, you decided to go to Boston and study at Berklee College of Music after never having a single lesson on any of the instruments that you played.
Mm-hmm.
Did that experience excite you, or did it turn you off to this process because it was so counterintuitive to what you had already done?
Both. Some things excited me. Some things I never really connected with. I think classroom learning was not necessarily the most intuitive for me. It was hard for me to wrap my head around one singular approach that a college has to take. You know, at the time it was like, this is harmony, and if it's not this, then it's either not right or not valid. And that was hard for me because I was like, but still sounds good over here. And so, especially at that time in my life, it was hard for me to like turn that part of my brain off and just really focus on like, accept like what was being given to me as one of many approaches. But also the people that I met there and made music with and relationships with, I was very into and intrigued by and learned worlds from, and a lot of those are still some of my closest friends today.
Well, you made it 2 semesters before you went on the road and started working as a musician. Yeah. Was that a scary proposition, or were you just excited to get out and do your thing?
It was a little unknown. There was this push and pull around work-school balance, and that could cost you grades, which could cost you scholarship, of which I did not have much to begin with. And so I was already going into a significant amount of debt, and I couldn't afford to like lose any of the scholarship money that I already had. But ironically, I was like, wow, this is cool. I'm working and supporting myself and paying my own rent outside of school, and I'm learning just playing at the jazz club at Wally's down the street. So it was kind of like that dichotomy that ultimately made the decision clear for me. Like, and also like my oldest daughter was on the way, so I was even more so thinking about the financial logistics of turning down work to like be in school and collect debt. And it was really kind of that simple. I came to Boston to learn. And so as long as I keep learning, then this plan will work for me. So I didn't end up returning.
In 2015, when you joined the Late Show band with John Batiste, you were first brought on as a producer and then as an instrumentalist. And then when John Batiste left, you took over as band leader. As your role shifted throughout the past decade within this particular band, what's been the biggest challenges for you as your role has changed?
I would say the energy management has definitely been one of the biggest challenges. There's a lot of decision-making that comes with the job, like music for this bit, that bit, walk-ons, balancing between what a guest may want to walk onto versus what I feel like would be right for the energy of the show to walk onto, and then have decisions about how to manage that, or if I can make an arrangement that like meets in the middle. That's kind of like one of the biggest parts of the job is, you know, making the musical fingerprint of the show consistent and at a certain level, and functionally making guests feel welcome, host feel comfortable, band feel utilized, audience engaged, the whole thing.
As a band leader in a long-standing TV show like that, you're joining the ranks of people like John Batiste and Questlove, but also like Doc Severinsen, Paul Schaefer, many others. What makes a great band leader?
That's a great question. Because there's categories that I get from the different guys that I've learned from. Batiste, the way that he would sort of set the environment musically in the room and like create a tonal through line from the warm-up before the cameras are even on to the last note of the closing theme. It gave the show sort of this musical fingerprint. He'd warm the crowd up with like one of his original songs, and then has his distinctive like voice and style of piano. But that also would carry over throughout, like in an interview, if the energy rises up and like there's a big laugh or something, you hear that same style of piano and laughter like from him in the cracks. And so it sort of like gives it this sonic identity. And I think that was part of what made him so great at the job. Someone like Paul Schaefer, he was just a really good sort of like having the band always tight, always prepared, but then personally being so good of a conversationalist to where the host could bounce off of him in conversation. He kind of occupied more of a sidekick to Letterman. That was a big part of what made him so great at the job. Doc, I think just having the band super tight and versatile at all times, all the footage that I went back and watched of him, every clip was just like, this could have been the album version, but it was just him like having like crystal clear, super tight arrangements for everyone from tap dancers to singers and everything in between, you know? So I feel like it's that answer to the question is maybe like an amalgamation of some of these things, support for the host, musical fingerprint and continuity, and musical excellence at the highest level.
You've played in church. You've been a side man. You've been a band leader. You might say that all of these roles have been in service to other things.
Yes.
But your recent album, Reflections, is 100% about you. What's harder, being in service of others or expressing yourself?
That feels like the snake that eats its own tail. Because initially, it's harder to sort of be in service of your own self. Because when you're in the service of others, there's a lot of information points that you can take in to hone in on other people's creative visions. You know, whether it be conversation, doing homework, research, listening to recordings, you can put together a grid of like preferences, and you can talk to other people that they've worked with and garner from that experience. I think when you're making music of your own, you're the only person that can really, truly get down into those things. So initially, my thought goes that that's harder. But the crazy thing is that the more you do that, the more it actually makes you then able to come back into those supportive roles and be more presently helpful in supporting others' creative visions.
Yeah. You began as a musician playing beside your mom, and you've continued down that path. In this lifetime of performing music, we know what the audience gets, but I'm curious from your perspective, what do you get from this musical transaction?
I think I get a lift, sort of elevation of vibration that comes in that collective thing. I get the joy of connecting with other humans. And there was one more thing. Oh, hope. Yeah, I think I get a little hope out of it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Soundly. If you like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Spread the word. Be sure to follow, rate us, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. To keep up on future episodes, follow us on Instagram at SpeakingSNDLY and visit our website, ArtfulNarrativesMedia.com. Tune in next week as we hear another inspiring artist speaking soundly.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.